The prophets communicated with the angels through these senses, and the Prophet of Islam went to Mi'raj, the ascension, with his spiritual body, and heard and saw things by his spiritual senses. These senses will be activated for all after they die.
In this world, the soul is not able to manifest its true potentials. It is governed largely by the constraints of the material world around it. And it is an uneasy, if you like, passenger in the vehicle that is the body. However, there is a purpose to this existence, and the soul requires to have this phase of its existence. But it really, if you like, flies and flourishes once it is free from that fetter of the body, and that is real life.
The spiritual body grows with us as we grow in this world. In fact, we have one aspect of this rooted in the middle world, and that is why we can communicate with that world in our dreams. So in this world, we live in two bodies, but since one is like an image of the other and completely matched on it, we realize that. Now, these two bodies belong to two dimensions of the same existence. On the moment of death, the soul discards its physical body and leaves this world with its spiritual body. So when we talk of death, we actually talk of ourselves in a new body, a body which is much more complicated and much more magnificent than our physical body.
The awareness, the power of the soul that is available to it, even in Barzakh, is exponentially different to that which was available to it in life. Even the kafir and the agnostic and the atheist, their ma'rifah and knowledge of reality is much greater than any scholar who's alive now, because the veils have been lifted and they see.
So every one of us leave this world in a spiritual body, a body which is lighter, fresher, and more agile than the body in which we are living now. A body with a special DNA partially created by us in this world. But what type of experience is death? Isn't going to be the same for all? Join me in the next episode of Discovering Islam to talk about this in more details. Until then, peace be with you.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. In the United States, Democrats are celebrating their unexpected victory retaining control of the U.S. Senate. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has more for us. As the balance of power in the United States House of Representatives remained unresolved on Sunday, 13th of November, Democrats are celebrating the projection that they won control of the U.S. Senate, marking a significant victory for Joe Biden as Republicans, backed by his presidential predecessor Donald Trump, underperformed in key battleground states. While senior Democrats remained guarded on Sunday about the chances of keeping control of both chambers of Congress, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi hailed the party's performance in the midterm elections, following months of projections indicating heavy losses. Who would have thought 2 months ago that this red wave would turn into a little tiny trickle, if that at all, Nancy Pelosi said. She added, "We're still alive for control of the House, but again, the races are close. We don't pray for victory, but you pray that God's will be done." As of Sunday morning, Republicans remained 7 seats shy of the 218 needed to win control of the House of Representatives, with Democrats requiring 14, an indication that a majority on either side will be slim. As internal discussions between House Republicans intensify over potential leadership roles, with Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy facing opposition from the far-right Freedom Caucus, Nancy Pelosi remains circumspect about her own future prospect, saying she would not make any announcements on her plans until after the House's control has been decided. Nancy Pelosi said, "My decision will then be rooted in what the wishes of my family are and the wishes of my caucus." She also referred to her husband, Paul Pelosi's ongoing recovery following a politically motivated violent burglary and attack at their family home in San Francisco, California last month. Nancy Pelosi added, "There are all kinds of ways to exert influence. The speaker has real power, but I will always have influence." The Democrats were projected to maintain their control of the Senate on Saturday evening when a tight race in Nevada was called for the incumbent Catherine Cortez Mastro, who defeated Adam Laxalt, a Donald Trump-backed former state attorney general. The result marks a substantial victory for the Biden administration's agenda over the next 2 years, not only with regards to potential legislative negotiation, but other powers which include appointments to the federal judiciary. Speaking to reporters in Cambodia during the ASEAN summit, President Biden congratulated the Senate leader Chuck Schumer, but appeared to acknowledge how a Republican-controlled House of Representatives might affect his agenda going forward. He said, "We feel good about where we are, and I know I'm an optimist and understand that from the beginning, but I'm not surprised by the turnout in this election." Joe Biden added that the Democratic Party's focus would move to the Senate runoff race in Georgia next month, where incumbent Raphael Warnock will face the Trump-backed candidate Herschel Walker, after neither candidate received over 50% of the vote in Georgia. A victory for Democrats in Georgia would hand them an outright majority of 51 in the Senate without needing Biden's Vice President Kamala Harris to break Senate ties in their favor. As fallout from the midterm elections continues, attention is likely to pivot to Florida next week, where Donald Trump is expected to announce a 2024 run for the presidency at his Palm Beach home, Mar-a-Lago. Although polling still indicates that Donald Trump is the preferred candidate among Republican base, his support has shown signs of fracture after many of his endorsed candidates performed poorly in the midterm elections last week. One opinion poll released on Saturday showed Donald Trump's support declining by 6 percentage points to 50%, while far-right Governor Ron DeSantis, who cruised to re-election victory last week, saw his support increase. On Sunday, Maryland's outgoing Republican Governor Larry Hogan, a longtime critic of Donald Trump, urged the Republican Party to move away from the former president's influence. Larry Hogan said, "The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result." He told CNN, "And Donald Trump kept saying, 'We're going to be winning so much, we'll get tired of winning. I'm tired of losing.' That's all he's done." Nonetheless, Larry Hogan, who himself is believed to be considering a run for presidency in 2024, acknowledged that ousting Donald Trump from the potential presidential nomination would be a difficult task. NBC News tells us more about the same story. President Joe Biden on Sunday, 13th of November, touted the results of the midterm elections, with Democrats projected to maintain control of the U.S. Senate following Democratic Senator Catherine Cortez Masto's narrow defeat of Republican candidate Adam Laxalt in Nevada. Joe Biden said, "We feel good about where we are. I'm an optimist," Biden told reporters in Cambodia. He added, he was not surprised by the turnout in the midterm elections. Democrats defeated several candidates backed by former President Donald Trump to hold on to at least 50 seats come 2023. Control of the House of Representatives has not yet been determined, with several races still too close to call. Before Cortez Mastro's victory, which put Democrats over the threshold needed to secure a Senate majority, Democratic Senator Mark Kelly of Arizona won his re-election contest in Arizona, defeating the Republican candidate Blake Masters, NBC News projected on Friday evening. Both Laxalt and Masters were endorsed by Donald Trump and boosted his false claims of widespread election fraud in the 2020 election. In an interview on NBC News Meet the Press on Sunday, Senator Bill Cassidy, a Louisiana Republican, blamed his party's underwhelming performance in the midterm elections on candidates who campaigned on Donald Trump's election denialism. Senator Bill Cassidy said, "I learned that the American people went a way forward that actually focuses on ideas, ideas that will make their lives better, not just their lives, but that of future generations." Senator Bill Cassidy added, "Those who are most closely aligned with the former president underperformed. Those who are talking about the future or who had managed their states well, they overperformed. The American people want ideas. They want a future." On Fox News Sunday, Representative Jim Banks, an Indiana Republican who chairs the Republican Study Committee, acknowledged that the election results were disappointing for his party. He declined to endorse Donald Trump. Trump has repeatedly suggested that he will soon announce his presidential bid for 2024. Despite calling Donald Trump a very popular figure in the GOP and a very effective president, Representative Jim Banks said he will save his endorsement for another place. The governor of Maryland, Larry Hogan, said he thinks it's time for the party to take a step backwards and figure out its priorities, pointing to Donald Trump for their lackluster performance in the midterm elections.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Bahrain has held its general elections. The regime was delighted. Authorities in the Sunni-ruled state, which crushed a 2011 anti-government uprising, said that the vote was free and put the turnout at 73%. But the vote was anything but free and fair. Rights groups called the voting environment of what is supposed to be a democratic process as political repression. They said there were highly restrictive measures that barred members of banned opposition groups. They added holding this general election will not address the atmosphere of repression and the denial of human rights that has gripped Bahrain for years. This, in essence, would make the vote a sham, that it would be void of holding any value. It was no surprise that Bahrainis took to the streets to protest the electoral process and announced that they would boycott the election, since it served the political trajectory of the ruling class. Bahrain experienced an uprising in 2011, still ongoing till this day, in which the Bahraini regime dissolved the main opposition groups and cracked down on dissent. The regime's crackdown over the past 12 years has been brutal. According to a 61-page report, the court is satisfied with the confession. Bahrain death sentences follow torture, sham trials. The regime has arbitrarily arrested more than 20,000 and tortured more than 6,000 victims. This also includes extrajudicial killings of more than 200 and political death sentences, the dissolution of opposition political societies, and the demolition of 38 mosques. And this is happening in a Persian Gulf country that is a key ally of the U.S. in the region, home to the U.S.'s Navy's Fifth Fleet, and also the United Kingdom, which opened a permanent military base in 2018. The powerful Shia cleric Shariza Qassam has said that the election means normalization. He said the elections constitute a test of the populace's awareness, explaining that to elect means opening the door for Bahraini citizenship-bearing Israelis to vote for parliament members. This would translate into how the electorate, meaning soldiers, dual citizens, security forces, those with personal interests in mind, and normalization advocates, would create a parliament for the government and not the people. The double standard approach by the UK and the US stands out when it comes to the issue of human rights and Bahrain. After all, Bahraini courts have convicted and sentenced defendants to death following manifestly unfair trials, based solely or primarily on confessions, allegedly coerced through torture and ill treatment. The governments of the US and the UK, as well as the European Union and its member states, should urge Bahrain, through both public and diplomatic channels, to halt all executions and to seriously investigate torture allegations and violations of the right to a fair trial. Yet they have chosen to do that with other countries, for example, Iran, which ironically has rioters out on the streets, endangering Iran's national security. According to Iran's intelligence minister, both the US and the UK even have a hand in the deadly protests, like to the CIA. A recent visit of the Pope to Bahrain posed an opportunity for the plight of Bahrainis to be addressed. 130 human rights organizations appealed to the Pope of the Vatican to demand the release of prisoners of conscience in Bahrain. They asked them to adopt an initiative urging the Bahraini authorities to end violations. But those hopes are dim. These 130 human rights organizations have cited how so many Bahrainis have faced discrimination, jail time, and torture. Yet Bahrain has always shifted the blame to Iran for the unrest. Could 130 human rights organizations be wrong, or for them to be lying? But Bahrain ultimately cannot have a democratic process because its big brother Saudi Arabia, which is just a stone's throw away, will be threatened by democracy taking place next door and will vehemently reject this, since it cannot risk having democracy creep into the kingdom. After all, Bahrain is joined only by a causeway to Saudi Arabia.
Hossein Amir Abdullahian warns of negative consequences if the UNHRC were to go ahead with demands of the West. He criticized the Western double standards when it comes to the issue of human rights. In a phone call with UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, he said, "Contrary to the UN Charter, few Western countries exploited the peaceful demands in Iran and encouraged violence and offered tutorials on building weapons and Molotov cocktails on media and social networks, which led to the killing of police and insecurity in Iran." He says that if a session is to be held on the riots in Iran, it should in fact probe into foreign governments' role in encouraging violence and terror and not on the country that is a true defender of human rights. What Amir Abdullahian is referring to is the piling evidence of actual foreign involvement in the riots, perhaps the most compelling of which was revealed through a joint statement by Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps and the Ministry of Intelligence. In it, the country's two top intelligence bodies pointed out the major role of foreign intelligence agencies, especially the CIA, in orchestrating the riots. They revealed that they have gone as far as dividing the riots in different stages of pre-unrest, during unrest, and post-unrest. Perhaps the primary way foreign governments, especially the US, UK, and Saudi Arabia, were involved was through supporting foreign Farsi-speaking media that played on people's emotions over a tragic death and capitalized on existing grievances to attempt to overthrow the Islamic establishment through something like a coup d'etat. Iran has warned the UK of consequences for hosting the so-called Iran International Channel, which Iran has recognized as a terrorist organization. Iran also warned Germany for voicing its support for the rioters and calling on the EU to implement more sanctions against Iran. Amir Saeed Iravani, Iran's permanent representative to the United Nations, responded to the US cries of women's rights and human rights being violated in Iran and its calls for a special session to, quote, highlight the ongoing repression of women and girls and members of religious and ethnic minority groups by saying this. The United States lacks the political, moral, and legal qualifications to hold such a meeting, distorting the very basic principles of human rights. He also added, the US has no true and genuine concern about the human rights situation in Iran or elsewhere. Perhaps he was referring to the role that the US has been playing in destabilizing the West Asia region and carrying out terrorist attacks there. Yemen, Syria, Afghanistan, and Libya, and its unwavering support for Israeli crimes against Palestinians, don't even begin to tell the whole story on US's destabilizing acts in the region. The UK's involvement in Syria, funding terrorist groups, and being one of the coalition members of the fight against Yemen also nullifies their cries over human rights violations anywhere in the world.
As the war drags on in Ukraine, the gloomy economic outlook continues to trigger protests across Europe. Demonstrators in several European countries have hit the streets for pay rises and better working conditions. In the UK, tens of thousands of nurses will go on a strike for the first time, demanding better pay as the cost of living soars. The industrial action would begin before the end of the year, after the first vote on strike action in its 106-year-old history. Unions say that the salaries of nurses have dropped by up to 20% in real terms over the last 10 years. That has left members struggling to feed their families and to pay their bills. Hundreds of workers at London's Heathrow Airport will walk out in the run-up to the Soccer World Cup this month over demands for better pay. The 700 workers will strike for 3 days starting from November 18th. In Greece, workers have held a 24-hour general strike, which has seen thousands of protesters march to the streets of Athens and the northern city of Thessaloniki. Clashes also erupted between protesters and police forces. And the French capital, Paris, commuters have faced transport delays. As metro workers called a major one-day pay strike, unions have staged strikes across several sectors in recent weeks, seeking pay hikes or increased hiring, as spiraling energy costs feed into widespread inflation. The protests come amid a gloomy outlook in Europe as Russia's war in Ukraine takes a rising toll on Europe's economies. The International Monetary Fund has predicted that Europe's advanced economies will grow by just 0.6% next year. It also says that this winter, more than half of the countries in the euro area will experience technical recessions. Germany, which is considered EU's biggest economy, is also expected to go into a recession in the next year.
The German economy has been built on cheap energy, cheap gas from Russia. And this business model is over. So Germany has to fastened to produce renewable energy and then go back on track with its business model. But this will take a couple of years.
Technically, a recession means that at least two consecutive quarters of shrinking output will occur. Next year, Europe's output and income will be nearly half a trillion euros lower as compared to the IMF's pre-war forecasts.
We have downgraded three times since October last year our growth projections. Last time we brought 22 to 3.2% growth, and for 23 projections was 2.9%. We will see, we always come around the annual meetings with our World Economic Outlook, that we are further downgrading our growth projections for next year.
The Eurozone has been battling against surging inflation for about a year. Inflation hit a historic high of 10.7% last month. Given the historic levels of inflation, the European Central Bank has announced three rate hikes this year, bringing the main rate from negative territory to 1.5% currently. Soaring costs with energy have been the main driver of higher inflation across the Eurozone.
From the insurrection in the US Capitol on January 6, 2021, to block the certification of the presidential election results to the October 28th attack on US House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's home. These incidents are among the most high-profile instances of political violence in America in recent times. Now, many believe the problem has gone from bad to worse in recent weeks. Harassment of political candidates and voter intimidation have been reported in many parts of the country, prompting some local authorities to elevate vigilance on Election Day. Also, threats against members of Congress are up tenfold. According to Capitol Police, more than 9,600 threats against members of Congress were recorded last year. Threats against federal judges have sparked 400% in the past 6 years to more than 4,200 in 2021. Also, election poll workers have received hundreds of violent threats, leading many to resign from their positions and discouraging others from volunteering in first place. Analysts believe the current trend of increased threats to lawmakers and election officials, extremist candidates running for office, disinformation and heated rhetoric are raising the risk of domestic terrorism and other forms of extreme violence in the United States. That's why a new survey suggests that almost 1 in 5 Americans agree that violence is sometimes needed to protect democracy when elected leaders will not. Therefore, U.S. politics is now in danger of spilling over into street violence as an answer to unwanted results. Nearly 9 in 10 Americans are concerned that political divisions have intensified to the point that there is a risk of politically motivated violence in the United States, and the 2022 midterm elections could act as a catalyst for future domestic extremist violence in the U.S. U.S. President Joe Biden has sounded the alarm over threats to democracy in his closing arguments ahead of the midterm elections.
Democracy is on the ballot. Political violence and intimidation are on the rise all across America. And you remember January 6th, the angry mob that stormed the U.S. Capitol, attacked law enforcement, hunted down elected officials, erected gallows to hang Vice President Pence. Well, West's opponent supported that mob. Who the hell do they think they are?
Biden has called on Americans to accept the election results and avoid resorting to violence. Also, former U.S. President Donald Trump said he's expecting a Republican victory in the elections. Trump has also vowed to make a big announcement next week, hinting that he's going to run for the 2024 presidential election.
This is the year we're going to take back the House, we're going to take back the Senate, and we're going to take back America. And in 2024, most importantly, we are going to take back our magnificent White House. I'm going to be making a very big announcement on Tuesday, November 15th, at Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, Florida.
The 2022 midterm elections are the first vote since the January 6th Capitol riot. Democrats have been campaigning around what they call the threat a Republican win would pose to U.S. democracy. Republicans, however, have focused their campaign on such issues as soaring inflation and the scale of violent crimes. Dozens of Republican candidates who could be elected as governors or elected administrators in key states have also echoed Trump's claims of fraud in his 2020 presidential election defeat. Election forecasters predicted that Republicans are likely to pick up roughly 25 seats in the 435-seat House of Representatives, more than enough to win a majority.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we said that Imam Khomeini returned to Tehran from the holy city of Qom after 10 months due to his health conditions. Today we are going to discuss the events related to the outbreak of the 8-year war which was imposed by the U.S. through its stooge, Saddam Hussein, the former dictator of Iraq. Stay tuned for more. After a few months of adventurism on the borderlines, the Ba'athist regime of Saddam in Baghdad started the military invasion of Iran on September 22, 1980. The war began with the bombardment of Iran's airports. Saddam hoped that the Islamic Republic of Iran could not resist the invasion and would soon collapse. The fact of the matter is that the 8-year war was imposed on Iran due to the fear of the U.S. and its allies from the spread of the Islamic Revolution to other Islamic countries. As Saddam was dreaming of leadership of the Arab world, he managed to unite almost all of the Arab regimes in one front against the threat of the non-Arab Iran. Thus, on September 22, 1980, Saddam ordered that 192 bombers and fighters should target Iran's major airports. In the afternoon, the Iraqi Air Force attacked the airports of Mehrabad in Tehran, Nojeh in Hamedan, and the airports of Tabriz, Sanandaj, Isfahan, Kermanshah, and some other cities. Simultaneously, the Iraqi ground force started invading Iran's soil on three fronts with three corps. Although the Iranian people were first feared of the Saddam attacks, in many of the border areas, people spontaneously hindered the advancement of the Iraqi army with little equipment and ammunition. Meanwhile, many of these people were forced to leave their homes and hearths. Moreover, the Islamic Republic Air Force shot down five Iraqi aircrafts on the first day of the invasion. Imam Khomeini's representative in the army, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, announced on TV, "The hired and mercenary Iraqi government has started the aerial invasion of the Islamic Republic of Iran's border and attacked several air bases. We had not intended to attack so far, but the Islamic Republic army does not tolerate the invasion of these Ba'athist stooges and will give a bitter lesson to Saddam." The Iranian Air Force attacked the Iraqi bases of Al-Rashid and Shu'aibiyah of Iraq just 2 hours after the Iraqi invasion. The next day, the Iranian Brave pilots targeted the air bases and communication and radar centers of the Iraqi Air Force with 140 bombers. Iran continued crushing air raids for another 2 days, which forced the Ba'athist army to transfer many of its aircrafts to Al-Walid Air Base near the Jordanian border to be out of the range of the Iranian fighters. However, the Iranian reconnaissance aircrafts chased them, and the Iranian pilots successfully operated the aerial fueling and reached Al-Walid Air Base to destroy many Iraqi fighters and bombers. The operation was called H-3 and was registered as an honor in the history of the Iranian army. Although the Iraqi invasion was a shock to the Iranian nation and governments, they were soon united behind Imam Khomeini and stiffly resisted the Iraqi criminal army with high morale. The officials in those days all spoke of the Imam's firm belief and his certainty of victory over Saddam and his invading army. On the first day of the war, Imam Khomeini said about Saddam's invasion, "Nothing has happened. Just a crazy man has thrown a stone." This showed his strong faith in God and godly promises. At the same time, he humiliated Saddam. Elsewhere in his remarks, the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran said, "We will resist, even if this war continues for 20 years. In those tough conditions, Imam Khomeini was so calm, as if nothing had happened. The Imam's wife, Ms. Khadija Saghafi, said, "I really hate war, and I am worried that how many dear ones will be lost. But I believe in the leadership of the Imam. I am sure that he will keep the country safe against the evil of Saddam. You too, don't worry." Imam Khomeini issued a message to the Iranian nation at 7 o'clock that day. In the message, the Imam asked the people to resist steadfastly against the Iraqi invasion.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Faith and Selective Duty, Monday the 6th of Ramadan, 1394, the 23rd of September, 1974. Someone who is a believer and wishes to remain so in order to enjoy the fruits of his faith must bear a sense of duty towards all of Allah's laws and must feel morally responsible at all times and places. Someone who believes that believing in Allah and believing in the Prophet give rise to moral duties will see that these moral duties are permanent and unceasing. One must always strive to be a servant of Allah. Each of us must do his utmost to serve Allah, believing in the Prophet, and announcing that you affirm him as Allah's messenger means that you now have a duty to follow the Prophet and adopt his path. If I affirm his prophethood like this and accept this moral duty, it means nothing if when something small happens and there is an opportunity to go against the way of the Prophet, I grit my teeth and clench my fists and stay strong and make a show of being a good Muslim. But as soon as something serious happens, something more painful, I turn around and forget my moral conviction. As the Arabic proverb reads, a lion amongst friends and an ostrich amongst enemies.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
So, on little issues, you are a lion, but when it comes to serious ones, you are an ostrich. All your courage is gone. This proverb means that when it comes to your own, you are a lion, but when you are facing enemies with swords, you become an ostrich. How does an ostrich fight? Does it have claws and teeth? Moral duties are not just for religious seasons. They are not for sometimes. They do not apply one day but not another. They do not apply to one person but not another. Duties are perpetual, universal, and eternal. The Quran rebukes the Israelites for saying on one occasion, our brethren must be protected, but on another, when it suited their personal interests, making war on these same brothers, killing them, taking them prisoner, enslaving them, selling them and looting their property. The Quran says, what? Do you believe in part of the book and defy another part? The Quran, Surah 2, verse 85. Do you believe in part of the religion? Are you faithful and moral when it is easy and convenient, and then at other times you're faithless? Is this even possible? Can you really separate one command from another and one duty from another, even when these are both from the same source and the same Lord?
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
While the U.S. regime baselessly accuses other countries of vote rigging, this regime itself has the most undemocratic and unhealthy election in the world. The U.S. has lost face, and American officials cannot hide this issue from the eyes of the world by simply putting a makeup on the face of their politics in their Zionist-controlled media. In this regard, we have provided different media views on this issue. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Kahan International wrote, the U.S. media is trying to distract attention from Washington's international terrorism by giving most of its space to the farcical midterm elections for the Senate and the House of Representatives, whose results will not end American crimes against humanity. The voters in the U.S. were being taken for a ride by the false promises of the candidates to control the growing inflation and curtail the ever-increasing murder of the innocents, mostly of the black-skinned, by either the white policemen or deranged gunmen that suddenly storm schools, marketplaces, and parks to slaughter for fun children, shoppers, and recreationists. The Zionist-controlled U.S. media, however, never details the crimes of the ruling regimes, whether Democrat or Republic, on a far greater scale around the world, with fatalities and casualties numbering millions, including in Syria, Iraq, Ukraine, Yemen, and Afghanistan, being the glaring examples of the suffering of entire nations at the hands of the American terrorists. Thus, for the free world, including the Islamic Republic of Iran, the elections in the U.S. and their results do not matter at all in view of the fact that Republicans and Democrats are two sides of the same coin. Republicans and Democrats are led by the filthy rich rogues, rascals, rowdies, and ruffians who thrive on the chicanery of the corporates to feed on the 99% deprived while distorting reality through the Wall Street Mafia, which churns out fake news of happenings in American society as well as all over the world. A prime example in this regard is the subservience of Washington to Tel Aviv and the whitewashing of Zionist crimes in order to project the oppressed people of Palestinians as terrorists. Another example is the depiction of China as a threat to world economy and of North Korea as a permanent nuclear nuisance. The NATO war in Ukraine is yet another case of the devilish deception of the U.S. regime to vilify Russia. Then there is the character assassination of President Bashar al-Assad, while it is the U.S. whose sadistic policy through its terrorist proxies has killed almost 500,000 people of Syria and displaced 5 million others as the illegally stationed Yankee troops continue to steal Syrian oil and wantonly target civilian centers. The same theft of millions of barrels of oil by the U.S. goes on in Iraq and Yemen, which the Americans and their clients have destabilized without the least bother for the half-starved and disease-stricken people of those lands who continue to heroically resist. Meanwhile, the oil-producing unrepresentative clannish regimes are being held in thrall by the U.S. and the Israeli regime to ensure a dirt-cheap supply of crude for the capitalist. Afghanistan has been left in tatters with no hopes of recovery anytime soon. Oil-rich Libya pushed into a civil war, Egypt placed under a military dictatorship, and the people of Lebanon are being chalked to a slow and painful death by the U.S., whose satanic nature is now fully evident in its stepping up of its 43 years of hostility against the Islamic Republic by openly backing Fox terrorists and traitors, while supplying them with weapons in vain hope of destabilizing Iran. The U.S. voters have no real information of these crimes against humanity of both the Democrats and Republicans, who are history's most evil terrorists that deserve to be decimated. If the American people really want justice and equity in society and become masters of their own destiny, whether the elephant seizes the donkey in its trunk and throws it out, or whether the donkey gives a nasty kick on the elephant's rump to drive it out, is not our concern, and we wish that the two of them will kill each other. Meanwhile, Truth Out wrote fossil fuel firms spent millions in bid to defeat Democrats in midterms. Ohio voters chose Trump-backed Republican J.D. Vance over Democrat Tim Ryan to fill a crucial Senate seat, and the race was a nail-biter until the end, seeking support from working-class voters in the state that former President Donald Trump won twice. Ryan ran a heterodox campaign with little support from the National Democratic Party, but the race was so competitive that Republican groups swooped in and spent at least $30 million to counter the congressman and boost Vance. A good chunk of that money was a gift from the fossil fuel industry. Ryan, a fierce critic of the trade deals that gutted manufacturing jobs across Appalachia and the Rust Belt, made it clear that he is no enemy of fossil fuels. Ryan wants Ohio to be a leading producer of clean energy technology, but he is also a big fan of fracking for natural gas, which provides jobs for his constituents and income for a region that saw coal mining and manufacturing collapse in recent decades. Ryan has backed away from supporting anything like a Green New Deal and is compared to Senator Joe Manchin, the conservative Democrat and coal champion from West Virginia, who obstructed President Joe Biden's agenda in an attempt to win concessions for the fossil fuel industry. While Republicans attack Ryan for voting against unpopular bill that would have deregulated polluters and opened sensitive ecosystems such as the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling, the fossil fuel lobby is more concerned about which party controls the Senate and how much Democrats can achieve before Biden leaves office. The industry spent lavishly on the 2022 midterms in hopes of flipping Congress over the GOP control and thwarting any effort by Democrats to fight climate change by reducing oil and gas pollution. As of October 19th, fossil fuel industry groups and companies such as Koch Industries and Chevron had donated $32.8 million to two super PACs aligned with Republican congressional leadership, according to a review of federal records by Sludge co-founder David Moore. The super PACs, the Congressional Leadership Fund, and the Senate Leadership Fund have spent more money on the 2022 midterms than any other outside groups. Fueled by wealthy industries and billionaires, campaign spending by outside groups reached a record $1.3 billion by mid-October, and total spending could be higher after largely unregulated super PACs spend the final weeks ahead of the election flooding the airwaves and internet with ads. The Senate Leadership Fund, which operates independently but is dedicated to winning Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, a GOP majority, was the top spender as of last month after reporting nearly $150 million in expenditures, according to Open Secrets. National campaigns are not the only target flush with cash from record profits. The fossil fuel industry poured money into lobbying and campaigns at all levels of government in 2022, including in states such as New York and California, where policymakers are pursuing cleaner energy and regulations to reduce the health impacts of pollution. The expensive efforts by the fossil fuel industry and its conservative allies to sway the midterm elections came as world leaders had gathered at the latest United Nations Climate Summit in Egypt. The World Meteorological Organization kicked off the summit recently by announcing that the past 8 years were on track to be the warmest 8 years on record due to ever-rising greenhouse gas emissions that trap the heat in the atmosphere. Extreme heat waves, drought, and devastating flooding affected millions of people and cost billions of dollars in 2022 alone, according to the UN Weather Agency's new report.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
A resolution was recently presented to the UN General Assembly for the first time after the Taliban took over Afghanistan. While discussing issues including security, terrorism, and the social and economic situation, the Assembly significantly refrained to recognize the Taliban as a government. Experts believe this could affect the nation.
Non-recognition of the Taliban by the global community could negatively affect Afghanistan. It would bring illegitimacy to the Taliban government. It would also have consequences for the country's diplomatic relations, trade, and culture. There may even be more sanctions. These could have adverse effects on people, especially the poor.
In response to this resolution, Suhail Shaheen, the head of the political office of the Islamic Emirate in Qatar, said according to Islamic principles and values, the Taliban are committed to fulfilling all the legitimate rights and demands of the people, and that they are trying to provide the right means and environment to achieve this goal. Experts say the recognition of the Taliban could have positive results.
If the Taliban government is recognized after the observation of human rights and some other standards by the Taliban, it could have very good results for the nation, such as in the fields of international relations and international economic interactions.
Since the Taliban took control 15 months ago, their non-recognition, along with the sanctions imposed on the central bank and the freezing of Afghan assets, has driven the economy of the country to the brink of collapse. It is believed the recognition of Taliban may be a way to improve the situation in the country. But on the other hand, releasing assets and removing sanctions could also be effective. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
Last winter was devastating for many Afghans, especially internally displaced families. Some lost their loved ones, while some were forced to sell their children and body organs to make ends meet. Yet this year, the UN Refugee Agency warns that the coming winter will even be more deadly and challenging for displaced people. According to the UN body, 79% of Afghans do not have adequate access to heating, and 79% households live in shelters that require repair. We are visiting a refugee camp in Kabul, where the people are struggling amid the looming cold season.
People here are facing many challenges. Neither the previous government nor the Islamic Emirate has taken any steps to address them. I know families here who are on the brink of starvation. They can't afford basic needs and struggle to survive. I wonder why the aid organizations are not reaching out to these families.
A woman who fled her house in Helmand during the U.S. war now lives in a cold shack, facing dire conditions. She says she uses plastic and paper wastes for cooking.
Look, I have no clothes, carpet, food, or home necessities. During the day, I have water with dried bread, even though I'm unable to chew. Look, this is my house. Its roof is so weak and perilous. Swear to God I'm suffering so much and facing numerous shortages. I don't know what to do. No one listens to us and no one hears our